Hello and welcome to The Curator on Monaco Radio with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Over the next 60 minutes, I'll be bringing some of the very best interviews and reports from the past week. This week, we meet chef Endo Kazutoshi.
Always my mom told me, I have to appreciate for everybody. The safe life is like that.
Plus, we feature an exciting new magazine about road trips.
There is a almost like an American culture thread of the road. And so it makes sense as an American travel brand that we would launch a magazine that has that angle, you know, that niche.
All that and much more here on The Curator with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We start the show with a great Toast Stories, the spin-off show of The Urbanist. This time, Sarah Grice recalls a fishy tale about the longest river in the British Isles, the Shannon in Ireland.
The Shannon is the longest river in the British Isles, running 350 kilometres in length. Its slow, steady passage divides the island of Ireland in two as it flows from east to west. The source of the river is the Shannon Pot, high up on the mountain slopes in County Cavan. The water issues from a deep pool, gradually becoming a small trout stream, which slowly but surely becomes the Great Wide River. It's Ireland's most vital waterway, steeped in Celtic history, poetry, myth and legend, and it flows through 11 counties before reaching its mouth in the Shannon Estuary in County Limerick. For most of its journey, the Shannon is tranquil and calm, as it's wide but not particularly deep, rising only 76 metres above sea level at its highest point. But at the place where it meets the Atlantic, where sky, river, marshland and sea come together, it's transformed. Here it becomes tidal, the waters suddenly choppy and wild before merging with the ocean. Like many great rivers across cultures and borders, the Shannon has an origin story that comes from the myths and legends of the land from which it flows. This story comes from ancient Ireland, long before medieval Christianity or Roman Catholicism took hold, or Viking or Norman invasions changed the landscape of the island, along with its culture, economy, and ecology. The creation myth of the Shannon predates the church and can be traced back to tales of Ireland's Celtic ancestors, populated by ancient tribes and pagan deities. These stories continue to be passed down orally and in the written word through poetry, art, and music, kept alive through storytelling and imagination from generation to generation. The story of the Salmon of Knowledge might be familiar to some listeners, the legend of a magical fish with red spots which lived in the waterways of Old Ireland. If caught and eaten, the salmon would bestow upon the finder the ultimate reward for the curious at heart, all the knowledge in the world. But there's another chapter to this tale. This chapter is less widely known and concerns the beginnings of the Shannon River, a cautionary tale like the story of Adam and Eve in the Christian and Hebrew sacred texts about the feminine quest for forbidden knowledge. While a man may fish for the salmon and consume its wisdom through eating its flesh, this other legend warns that if a woman eats of the salmon of knowledge, she will not live to tell the tale. Our story begins with a woman named Shannon, or Shannon in the Irish, who went to the well where the mystical fish was said to be swimming. Despite the warning of the ancestors, she was hungry for knowledge and thirsty with curiosity. She wanted to know everything there was to know about this world and all the other worlds. She found the well and she caught the salmon. She cooked the fish and began to eat. As she ate, her skin began to glow. The girl was rapt with sensual ecstasy and carnal pleasures. The sweet smell of the fish, the rough touch of its skin, the taste of its flesh. Her whole body began to radiate light, and Shannon shone with an aura that rippled through her entire being. She felt the blood rushing in her veins, and her eyes glittered with fire and poetry. All at once, she could see into the past, present, and future. She understood the meaning of all languages, human and non-human tongues, and animal voices, the powers of speech belonging to plants and animals, fish and flowers. In her rapture, she leapt into the air and she fell down into the dark, deep well. The water poured forth and washed her out of the land of the living. Her body was never seen again. She disappeared from corporeal existence and was transformed, becoming one with the river itself. This metamorphosis of a girl who wanted to know the answers is the story of the River Shannon. That's how it got its name. There are many ways to read a myth, and I like to think that perhaps, although the young woman was destroyed in physical form for daring to defy the will of the gods, she was resurrected as a river deity, the goddess of the Shannon, whose brave curiosity was the source of its power. Water is a substance that no human or creature or ecosystem on Earth can survive without, just as Ireland's natural infrastructure relies on the nurturing flow of the Shannon River. Maybe this myth in some way reveres this natural curiosity and shows the powerful transformation of a woman in pursuit of knowledge. The Salmon of Knowledge. In Celtic mythology, the other world, or the realm of the dead, is a treacherous and magical place, filled with fairies and sprites, temptations and forbidden fruits. There is much that can be learned from its strange old ways, but every piece of knowledge comes with a price. Like Eve, Shannon tasted the thrill of knowledge, the discovery of bodily pleasures, from eating the fish, and was punished. Or was she? If punishment is becoming a river goddess and experiencing knowledge, then maybe that's a fate worth suffering for and being transformed for. My family originates from County Limerick, and the Shannon has always been a great source of joy, inspiration, and poetry for the inhabitants of Limerick City and County Clare. Walking by the Shannon is hearing birdsong and seeing poetry in the rushes, the ripples in the water, the sight of the swans. There is so much work going on around the Shannon these days, in terms of its tourism, art projects, archive, and heritage. A fact which is unsurprising, as its waters make up a total of 1/5 of Ireland's total land area. In 2021, the Shannon Tourism Master Plan set out a new vision for sustainable tourism along the Shannon's waterways, positing the river and its developing regions as key tourist destinations within the heartlands of Ireland, offering up its stories, its poetry, the wild beauty and wildlife to visitors from all over the world.
We head to the US now to hear how Norway is leveraging its enviable soft power assets to promote its brand abroad. As companies the world over are eager to do business on the US West Coast, how can small nations attract the attention of tech titans and Silicon Valley venture capitalists? Team Norway think it might just have a secret weapon. Monaco's Seattle correspondent Gregory Scruggs joined a recent business delegation to find out more.
So it's a pleasure and a privilege to have you here. And it's also my great pleasure and great honor to welcome Your Royal Highness, Crown Prince Håkon, to the stage. Crown Prince.
We have very much been looking forward to coming to Seattle and to highlight many of the possibilities of cooperation between companies here, institutions here, and counterparts in Norway. Today's conference is focused on the green transition and the ocean industries. Norwegians have been shipbuilders and seafarers since the Viking Age. We have maintained our expertise not just by staying true to tradition, but also by constantly thinking along new lines, adopting to change and seeking broad cooperation. The spirit of innovation is alive and well and is more crucial than ever as the maritime industries take steps to achieve the green transition.
A royal visit is a guaranteed way to attract attention when traveling abroad. And if you are a Norwegian delegation, then your nation's crown prince is among your top soft power assets. The 50-year-old heir apparent to the Norwegian throne is a talented diplomat with special ties to the region. For starters, he earned his bachelor degree from the University of California, Berkeley. And when he traveled north from the San Francisco Bay Area to Seattle, he was met by a traditional Norwegian greeting party. After all, the city was largely settled by Nordic immigrants and hosts the world's largest celebration outside of Norway of the country's Constitution Day, known as 17 Mai or 17th May. That historical connection, coupled with Washington State's robust technology and maritime sectors, made Seattle an obvious stop. To find out how Team Norway lands valuable face time with top executives and elected officials, I tracked down the delegation's organizer on a busy morning at the National Nordic Museum.
I'm Håkon Haugli. I'm the CEO of Innovation Norway, which is a state-owned company providing services to Norwegian businesses. So we do everything from trade promotion. So we are now in Seattle on a trade promotion activity. We also provide financing, loans and grants to entrepreneurs and companies undertaking innovative work or establishing a new company. And we also do tourist promotion. So Visit Norway is part of our portfolio. So it's a pretty broad portfolio. For a small country like Norway, it makes sense to bundle tasks together.
Now, we just heard from His Royal Highness Crown Prince Haakon introducing the event, today's mission to Seattle. What is the importance of having a figure with such star power like His Royal Highness in opening doors when you are organizing these trade missions?
Yeah, the key phrase there is opening doors. He's a very effective magnet for the counterparts when we visit a country. He goes on quite a few of these missions. Last year we were in Germany, and the year before we were in London, and we see that it gives us results. The companies, and we just came from San Francisco, contracts were signed, a lot of hands were shaken, and investments were announced, investments from Californian venture capitalists into Norwegian startup companies. So it gives an immediate effect, but in the long term, it also provides us with a platform to work from, because those connections can be built on through the coming months and years. And we know this recipe works because we see it. And the Crown Prince is somebody that people would like to meet. So we get a higher level attention from companies than we would normally or otherwise do. And we get to visit some of the world's leading companies, as we will here in Seattle as well. We'll go to Microsoft and Amazon, and the Crown Prince will lead delegations there. And we get top management attention, which of course is of great importance for our companies, our customers. What we try to do here whenever we go somewhere is to position Norway as a superpower in the green and digital space. We are a world leader in electric cars, world leader in electrifying maritime transportation. We are very digitally advanced, and that provides us with some bridges that we can build. And of course, it helps a lot that both our government ministers, but also someone like the Crown Prince engages in that conversation.
To understand how a crown prince who opens doors can generate tangible business opportunities for Norwegian entrepreneurs, I caught up with one of the delegates, hoping to land a deal.
So my name is Siv Remevangen, and I'm the managing director at a company called Norwegian Electric System. And we are a maritime supplier and a system integrator providing energy power, automation, and navigation system for vessels. We find this trade mission or trip to be very interesting because there are so many things going on now outside of Norway, and we see that both California and Seattle, or state of Washington, have so many similarities with Norway and the West Coast in particular. And our company has been involved in the electrification of the ferries along our Norwegian coast since, I think, 2017. We have delivered system for 50 to 60 vessels, 30 charging stations. And now we see that both California and the state of Washington are really exploring how they can also electrify their fleet. So the purpose of this trip is basically to get more insight on where they are, what they are interested in, and to see if there can be mutual collaboration opportunities.
Is this your first attempt at doing business here in the United States?
Unfortunately, it is not. As a company, we tried a few years back. There was a big tender with Washington State Ferry, and we were a part of that try. But because we didn't have, you know, feet on the ground and a local presence, we were unable to come in as number one. We came in as number two.
So here we are a few years later, and you're giving it another shot. But this time, as part of a team, Innovation Norway brings a whole raft of companies together. You're not just going it alone.
Are you more confident the second go around because you have the backing of Innovation Norway?
Absolutely. I mean, we have gained so much insight of the opportunities here. They've opened the doors and we're having multiple meetings with local companies after this summit. So for us, this is just the first step.
We are back with the curator and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Time for a highlight of the menu, our food and drink show. This time, Endo Kazutoshi joins us in the studio to discuss how times of struggle can ignite a genuine passion and what makes the cut in his omakase restaurant.
I never thinking about this sushi chef. This is not my work. It's kind of my destiny. So you already mentioned too about my background. Is I born in a sushi restaurant. So actually my grandpa opened a sushi bar in 1940. I'm first son. Maybe England as well. It's first son. It's allowed to kind of take responsibility over the family. So my big sisters and I, is the gap is 8 years old. So my family, everybody looking for the first son. Then I'm born. So I was 5 years old, already my mom educated me about the chef. Of course, I'm not using knife, but kind of mentality. And so we call it to Shinzui, like essence of the chef. For example, I learned tea ceremony and flower arrangement, also calligraphy. The basically in Japan, these young kids, after school, everybody go to the baseball and play to with friend. I don't have nothing experience this. Always after school, straight go to the kind of, that's like every day, Monday to Saturday. The Sunday, always I'm supporting the restaurant. That's my kind of like my key of the how to grow to my mentality of the chef, I think.
The idea of mentality of the chef is so interesting when then you look at the way that your training evolved as well, yeah. Right? Because yeah. Anyone who's kind of a bit clued up on how sushi chefs train will know that it takes a while before you can actually get in front of customers. Mm. A lot of the work that leads you there is actually behind the scenes, is doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. And that happened to you as well, didn't it? And how did it feel, both practically but also mentally?
That's maybe key as well. I went to high school and university. That university is worst things. I get the teacher's license of the physical education. I have a master of the sports science, sports technology. Then 3 high school offer me the teach. That for me is a great opportunity. Then 1 week I'm thinking, I was 22 years old, I'm thinking maybe better I choose my dream. Then family meeting, my parents, my big sister, my young brother and I, we chat. Okay, I'm sorry about it. Unfortunately, I take over the family business because chef mentality is quite unique. It's unusual. For me, like in the beginning, it's very struggling.
But at what point did that struggle turn into a passion? At what point did you actually fall in love with doing it? Maybe it wasn't cleaning fish for 3 years at that restaurant, but how did that feel? And at what point did you shift?
Actually, seriously, 1 year is I'm no passion because, you know, I have many people. I'm an educator as well and an ex-restaurant now as well. I saw the young chef cutting anything. We catch already. He's feeling no great, also no passion today, no sick, like something like that. That's why always I'm shaken in the morning. Hi, how are you, everybody? Then I catch a feeling. Maybe my master already, I met him and he understanding. Then 1 year later, we go to drink together. He asking me always like, what's my feeling? What's my future plan? What's my dream? I speak to him straight, nothing. I'm take over my family business. Family business is going well. It's consistency. That's my dream. He told me 3 years. Okay, Endo, 3 years is okay. 3 years work with me. Then you try your best. Then after 3 years, nothing happening. He decide me, maybe I have to keep going to chef or I choose my dream. 3 years, you have to concentrate after let's talk. So that 3 years only, it's okay. 3 years is okay. So please work with him. I tried my best. So my senior chef also supporting a lot. So about how chef is good, how, you know, chef life is great. That's most of my memory as well. One of the guests ordered like a bento box. It's a maki roll, three maki rolls. So he's a takeaway. He ordered takeaway. He ordered me. So can you make for me sort of one bento box? Then the guest next day coming back to me, he say, incredible, that's amazing. All the family is happy. Then I'm little bit changing. I made some people happy. That little by little, the experience is coming to me. So for me, it's little by little understanding, that's not for me. Why I create for the guests, for the, my environment. That's kind of like appreciation. Then I'm back to the beginning. I was kids. Always my mom told me, I have to appreciate for everybody. The chef's life is like that. So maybe that's almost big change in my, that's my point in the beginning, I think, in the chef life.
What's your relationship with tradition? Because we talked so much about this felt like a destiny to you, and you had a very strict, in some respects, training in it, very traditional in many respects. What's your relationship with tradition now? Do you think that there is room to change in such a hallowed world of cuisine like that of sushi tradition?
Tradition meaning like how I grow, also how I learn, then I improve. That's my key in the beginning. After that, I have to innovate. I work with many chefs. I catch inspire. Then I innovation. But key is like how they teaching me, I'm improve. That's maybe very important. Then after that innovation, that's maybe the way of the tradition. But for me, the skill wise also, I follow up to my master's way. Then a little bit my essence together. That's kind of an innovation. It's very sensitive about tradition or not tradition. Even Tokyo style. Tokyo style is in the beginning, is 150 years ago, 100 years ago, the sushi chef in Tokyo, they using fish from the Tokyo. But now impossible. Though everybody we discuss about what's a Tokyo style, what Tokyo style sushi, maybe kind of mentality, the spirit of that way. That's maybe key. That's why individually sushi chef is different tradition, I think.
Our letter from is from the resort town of Nida, part of Lithuania and just 5 kilometers from the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad. Monaco's Chris Chermak and Lily Austin both visited this peninsula separately over last summer and have combined their energies to reflect on what makes this Lithuanian resort town special.
So, Lily, we made a rather surprising discovery a while back that we had both been to this tiny little Baltic resort, the town of Nida in Lithuania, in the space of the same few weeks last summer. What are the odds? What brought you there?
I know, it's certainly a niche choice for non-Lithuanians, but from what I'm told, Nida is the summer hotspot for natives, so it seemed like the natural place to finish a week-long road trip around the country. A headline act, if you will. What about yourself? Why were you there?
Headline act. I was wearing a bit of a sort of holiday hat and a reporting hat at the same time. I was on a couple weeks long trip around the Baltics. First trip for me to the region was drawn by the resort, but also just the fact that Nida is 5 kilometers from the Russian border of Kaliningrad. And what's more, it's not even linked to Lithuania itself. It's on this peninsula called the Curonian Spit. It's half Lithuanian and half Russian, but you actually have to take a ferry across from Klaipėda on the Lithuanian mainland to get there. And I, as many listeners will know, love a good ferry.
I love a good ferry too, and it was such a little ferry. I love a baby ferry. And yes, the Russian-Lithuanian border right down the middle of the spit is an interesting feature. Kaliningrad gives Russia access to the Baltic Sea. It's its most western outpost. So on the one hand, you've got the Korean Spit making headlines because of military activity on the border.
Troops have amassed in the forests of Lithuania in recent
And then on the other side, you've got Lithuanian families walking on the UNESCO protected dunes and festival goers dancing on the beach, totally unaware. Which camp do you fall into?
Definitely the dunes camp, I have to say. The dunes were fabulous. I really loved it. I mean, the history of them was pretty incredible as well. These sand dunes are so powerful that they literally overtook sections of the peninsula and buried 4 early developments underneath them up into the 19th century. Residents reforested the dunes at various points after that to kind of firm them up and stop them moving around so much. But there is a part of the dunes you can go to where there's an art installation that is like a cemetery to these lost cities, crosses in the sand. Something tells me, though, you were in the festival camp. What did I miss?
I love those dunes too. They're amazing. But I guess I'm more on the festival camp, but unfortunately we came a few days too early for the festival. We missed it by like 2 days. Ant Bangos translates to on the wave. But when we were there, we saw all the tents being put up on the beach and the influx of Lithuanians, young hot things, Lifluencers, if you will. If this kind of people watching appeals to you, I strongly recommend the bar Sangrita Nida. One standout moment from my trip there was enjoying the eponymous cocktail of a couple of festival goers in waiting who really excitedly pointed across the bar at Lithuania's biggest Instagrammer. So I looked her up, very curious, and saw that she had 600,000 followers, which I thought, yes, it's not a bad number. It's not Kylie Jenner good, but it was pointed out to me that Lithuania has a population of 2.8 million. So that's actually kind of incredible.
That is impressive, definitely.
Yeah, but having said that, Nida as a glamorous music scene is a pretty recent development. Traditionally, it's best known for its wildlife, thanks to those dunes we talked about in the woodland. Bird watchers were descending on the town long before the people watchers. But am I right in thinking you were interested in it from more of a historical angle?
Well, partly because I just stumbled on some German history while I was there, and given my Austrian roots, I just couldn't resist. The Curonian Spit was actually, and parts of Lithuania, belonged to Prussia for a time in the 19th and 20th centuries. The most notable bit of history in Nida was the German writer Thomas Mann, who kept a summer house in Nida back before World War II. It's been turned into a museum and cultural events venue, and when I went there, they were practicing a small classical music concert for the arrival of a larger German tour group. They were from an aviation magazine. They were coming for the evening, and that's what you're hearing at the moment. I did still hear a lot of German around Nida, and it is the German tourists that actually dominate this resort when it's not the Lithuanians themselves.
Oh, well, this is news to me. I only encountered Lithuanians when I was there.
Which is actually totally fair, because some of the people I spoke to said much of the tourism has been limited to Lithuanians since the pandemic and Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
At the moment, is most of all, we have the local guests, like Lithuanian persons, but because of a global situation of Ukrainian war, we have here Kaliningrad, couple kilometers from us. It's really safe, but foreigners, tourists, doesn't know it.
This is Gytis. He's a general manager of the Jūrate, a 200-year-old hotel that has ambitions of returning to its imperial glory days.
Before war, before COVID situation, 80% of our clients was German. But as you live here now, and we have group of Germans, so it's, yeah, we fully booked it. Yeah, good. We are happy.
It's like old times.
Yeah.
I was struck speaking with Gytis about how understanding he was about this whole thing, saying he too would not want to travel to a place that's ostensibly near a conflict area. He mentioned Romania, for example, even if the locals assured him that it was completely safe. So until the war ends, Gytis is happy for the support of Lithuanians. And what did you learn from your Lithuanian friends about why they find it special?
It does just seem to come back to the nature of the place. Lithuania is full of lakes and forests, but there's a unique kind of beauty to this particular spot. Here's my friend Almantas Pakunas.
There's a certain type of poetry there where people coexist with nature, and they depend on each other. It has these long, long beaches with perfect fine sand and beautiful pine tree forests. So it's really a destination for many Lithuanians to go on holidays, to get away from the cities and have that tranquility and connect with nature again.
I have to say, I totally agree with Amantis, and I hope the foreign tourists do rediscover this place in the upcoming spring and summer months. It really is worth the trip, even if a part of me wants to keep this protected bit of land just between you and me, Lily. Would you return, maybe for the festival you missed?
Absolutely. For the Techno Festival and for the Thomas Mann Museum. Cover all bases.
For Monocle, Inida.
I'm Lily Austin.
And I'm Chris Chermak.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You are with The Curator, a weekly highlight show here on Monocle Radio. And now we have a highlight from the Foreign Desk. And this time we speak with Maria Gavunelli, director of the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy, also known as ELIA MEP. I began by asking her whether Greece has a newfound confidence in foreign policy compared to the depths of the Eurozone debt crisis.
We have gone through these very traumatic crisis. Traumatic simply because for people of my generation who were born and bred European, to suddenly find ourselves at the brink of collapse with a bankruptcy in our hands, that was really the major trauma of our lives. So yes, the fact that we can actually stand up on our two feet and we're doing better, we're not necessarily doing great, but we're doing certainly better. So that is important. And that shows in the confidence that we have, that shows in the projection of Greece all over the place. We have gone through some very dark days. We try to forget them. I hope that we do not forget them too quickly, but we would certainly be ready for a better situation. The risk nowadays is perhaps a question of high expectations, how we can manage not to be too confident, but rather realize that, okay, we're doing better, but there is still risk. There's still quite a lot of work that needs to be done.
I mean, that's obviously a much more preferable bunch of problems to have. And the person, I guess, who has to address them is the current Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis.
Clearly.
Do you get a sense of how ambitious he is as a foreign policy Prime Minister?
Well, I think that I get the sense, to be more specific, that if they manage to come up with a major breakthrough, for instance, in our relationship with Turkey, they would consider that as part of their legacy. And that would indeed be something very, very important indeed. On the other hand, they have already done quite a lot of things. For instance, in terms of law, the sea, for instance. Mm-hmm. My morning job, as I always say, is professor of international law at the University of Athens, and this is my specialty. Greece has been a very active participant in the negotiations for the Law of the Sea Convention 50 years ago. And then suddenly we rested on our laurels, and that was that. And it was only very recently, under the current government, that we were able to actually implement properly the provisions of the Law of the Sea Convention and therefore have an EEZ in this country. And that's important. We have started talking about energy corridors at sea. We have been talking just about protected areas. Do you know for how long we have been talking about these protected areas?
I'm guessing a while.
Decades? So suddenly you see things happening, and that is important.
The particular foreign policy challenge you mentioned, the relationship with Turkey, which I guess is the first thing that anybody who arrives in power in Greece starts thinking about, what's the actual optimum outcome there? How good can that relationship ever get? Is it imaginable that, for example, Greece and Turkey would get along at least as well as, I don't know, France and Germany do now?
Oh, I wish. I sincerely don't believe that that will be the case in my lifetime, to be absolutely and brutally frank. However, we have gone through a period when we have not been talking to each other. And that is tragically wrong, and it is actually extremely dangerous. So I think that what we need to do is to agree to disagree and move on and make sure that we can actually live not necessarily together, but necessarily side by side. We are condemned by geography and history, and we have to make do. I had a colleague, a Turkish colleague, telling me some time ago that, but why should we have this botheration between ourselves? We were all parts of the same empire. And I was just looking at him. I said, you know, if that's the way you approach things, perhaps we need to restart our discussion, isn't it? Because that really is telling, isn't it?
But is it conceivably one of those things? And perhaps the better question is, does Kyriakos Mitsotakis see it as one of those things where a personal relationship can make a difference? He's going to Ankara fairly shortly. Is it a relationship that could conceivably be reset just by whether or not Mitsotakis and President Erdogan are those two people, but by having the right two people in those positions at the same time?
Well, the right two people in terms of functional cooperation, I would argue. I don't think that's a question of personal chemistry. In fact, I would suggest that there is no personal chemistry. There's nothing common between those two people. But if we can actually move ahead and just work together, I think that would be important. What is equally important, and I think this is something that we somehow forget in domestic politics, is that foreign policy is not just the bilateral issue with Turkey.
Sure.
And the fact that Greece nowadays is able actually to project itself beyond the bilateral issue, place itself in the wider Mediterranean, place itself in the southeastern European side and the Balkans, and beyond Balkans, start talking about what is happening in corridors from Mimac to India and beyond, and shipping, and the newly re-established corridor from Alexandroupolis to Constanza, and then on to Ukraine, and then to parts north. I think these are all very, very important issues. And of course, the ongoing cooperation with the US, which builds on a very old coalition and friendship that is also historical and cultural and all kinds of other things. So the fact that we are now again participating in this international debate, that by itself is extremely important.
Is there more that Greece could or should be doing, though, especially in terms of maritime security? You mentioned shipping, which is obviously tremendously important to Greece, and Greece controls, for a country of its relatively small size, an astonishingly disproportionate amount of global freight tonnage. Does Greece need to make more of an effort and make itself more prominent in protecting those shipping lanes? And we have seen, obviously, in recent months how vulnerable they can be, particularly turning left out of the Suez Canal.
Exactly. But you see, Greece was there. And this time around, Greece did not simply participate. They were actually heading the Operation Aspides in the Red Sea. And the reason they have actually sought to do so was simply because we have to put our mouth where our money is. We are, in fact, one of the major players in international shipping. We might as well do something about the security of international shipping. It would have been inconceivable to do otherwise. Now, whether that is something that would cost us money, absolutely. Whether that is something that might actually overexert the Navy, for instance, that has gone through the crisis as well and has also other commitments in the Eastern Mediterranean, yes, and undoubtedly so. But that comes part and parcel of the whole idea of securing your economic lifeline at the end of the day. Who else is going to do that for us unless we do it ourselves?
We're back here with the curator and our highlight from Monaco on Design, the limited edition run of a new title that reproduces the final notebook of the late architect Louis Kahn, has been published by Lars Müller. Sue Ann Kahn and Mark Mazziello join us with more.
I've always wanted to share this notebook with everyone because I think it really shows my father's personality in a way, because it's full of his drawings. Also notes for lectures, collecting names and addresses at a party, a little drawing of a star. His very poetic nature comes through. And he used this book on and off during the last year of his life. So in researching it and sharing it, I was able to experience the last year of his life in a way I never could when he was alive.
And this was, I believe, quite a serious labor of love, because you've had this notebook, and I believe some others in your possession for a while, but I think it took about 15 years for the original idea for this to be turned into this book that we're seeing now here in Milan.
I've tried on and off for the last 15 years to have it produced, but finally Lars Muller, who is one of the best publishers of books in art and design, finally agreed to do it a year ago. And in a year, we published a facsimile as well as a companion volume that tells you what you're looking at and gives the story of the notebook.
I mean, this is a facsimile, as in it's a direct copy of the notebook. There's even, which I only learned last night, Suan, that there's even a little ink stain on the cover, which is pretty amazing. I'm holding it here in my hand. And you've left the blank pages as they were. And then, of course, there's the second book, which is an essay and also an explanation of the illustrations. Mark, I'm going to bring you in. Maybe you can tell listeners what your involvement in the project is. How do you come into it?
Sue Ann and Greg, her son, approached my company, Form Portfolios, which I'm the founder of, asking us to help open a new chapter in Louis Kahn's legacy, which most people, it's sort of hidden in plain sight, the fact that he designed furniture and lighting fixtures for his buildings. We go and experience these buildings, and we're all in awe of them. At least I am. Everyone I go to feels like it's a temple. And I feel this spirituality when I'm in a Louis Kahn building. We forget or don't really see, because we see the forest, but we don't necessarily see the trees that comprise the forest. And some of those trees are furniture and lighting. And we are creating it's called the Monumental Modernism Collection of Furniture and Lighting by Louis Kahn, and will be introduced starting next year for the first time ever.
Obviously, we'll start with you, Suan. Your father passed away quite a while ago now. How do you hope that this book will perhaps restart the conversation? As I was saying earlier, he's still so respected for his work, especially, of course, amongst architects and designers. But how do you hope maybe this book may connect with the new generation and start a new conversation about his work?
This is, in a way, a commemorative publication, because he died 50 years ago. That spurred the publication of this, actually, the fact that it's a commemorative moment. And the hope is that this will reach young people. There's a lot of blank pages in there, and I was hoping that young people would get away from the computer and the phone and actually draw some things in there themselves. I'm hoping that it will just show another side of my father, a very human side, because he was a fun guy. He liked to especially connect with young people, and as a teacher, beloved by his students. And I was hoping this would have a new conversation about his legacy and his work.
Mark?
I think it is a window into the mind of somebody that many people admire his work, and now you see his notes and his sketches and his musings, and it's a window that is rare to see.
Maybe we can just talk a little bit more about actually the contents in the book. We did touch upon it earlier, but just, I know you've said a lot before, you know, that your father was always doodling. He always had a notebook in his hand. He never went anywhere without one. And when he wasn't drawing in his notebooks, he was drawing on napkins or newspapers. There's everything in here from phone numbers, aren't there, to doodles, you know, or not even doodles, actually sketches and drawings for projects. I mean, it's a real mix of stuff that maybe helps get us inside his head a bit.
Yes, and this is a private diary. This was never meant to be published or seen by anybody else, really. It's just a diary for himself, in a way. So he has drawings, very, very first drawings of a project in the Roosevelt Memorial in New York, and then the very last drawings that he made of it. And so they're drawings, notes for speeches, where he's really he's collecting his own thoughts on paper in a very architectural way, and almost like poetry. And it's just the way he had a book that he could draw in or put his thoughts in if he wished to. And that's the approach to any kind of notebook that he had.
And now a highlight of my show, The Stack, which is all about magazines. This time I spoke to travel publishers Wild Sand. They have launched their new publication, Wild Sand Magazine. We speak with its editor-in-chief, Taylor Bruce.
Before Wild Sam, I was in the magazine world. I was a staff editor at a Southern Culture magazine here in the States for 3 years, and I was a freelance writer for a bunch of publications. So, I mean, that was very much informative of Wild Sam, the field guides. You know, if you look at our books, they do have the TOC has a magazine quality, even though the books, you know, they're not shaped like a magazine physically, but there's sort of a front of book and a feature. And, you know, the way we do interviews harkens back to sort of an Esquire model of, and so magazines are certainly in the DNA of Wild Sam, but no, we did not think about Wild Sam as a magazine from the get-go. And in some ways it was the brand sort of had about a 10-year run to bake before the idea even occurred to us to do a magazine.
The magazine itself, it feels to me, it is a love letter to the road trip, right?
Right.
Which in that sense, it kind of connects to the guides in a way.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, we have a series of books that are road trip guides, and road trips, you know, they factor into, you know, our National Park series and our Pursuit series as well. So we're certainly familiar with that mode of travel. It also feels there is a almost like an American culture thread of the road. And so it makes sense as an American travel brand that we would launch a magazine that has that sort of that angle, you know, that niche. It felt right when we were concepting what can Wild Sam magazine be. We wanted it to have a bit of a unique point of view, and the open road, as we sort of call it, you know, is that point of view, which is kind of a mix of curious travel that blends outdoor pursuits and, you know, road trip culture. Stateside, at least, there's been a return to that sort of nostalgic form of travel in the last 4 or 5 years. There's certainly been a fascination with vehicles that sort of cater to that type of travel, you know, whether it's the vintage Airstream, you know, or more of a kind of a classic RV, you know, that type of experience has sort of like resurfaced for a new generation. That's what this magazine is all about.
And I think it's quite an ambitious launch as well, because it's, from what I can see here, is not a biannual. It's not just kind of a thing that you're going to see just time to time in the newsstand. You are already at issue 3, and the first issue was published January 2024. So perhaps not quite a monthly, but it's ambitious. It's nice. So you do believe in the print product.
Yeah, I mean, we will do 8 print issues a year. And in between, we'll do seasonal digital issues. We wanted the consistency. I mean, part of the beauty of a magazine is that, you know, they sort of show up on your doorstep within a few weeks of each other. So it's almost like a fairly consistent conversation, dialogue with the reader. And, you know, I certainly understand the business challenges that the magazine industry faces, but when you only do 2 or 4 issues a year, the reader can sort of forget about what had been building, you know, in terms of the stories that you're sharing. So yeah, it's, you know, it's a 100-page magazine, it's 8 times a year. And, you know, our team, we had sort of gotten into a rhythm of doing about 12 to 14 books a year. And so we're used to having multiple things going at once. And so the rhythm of doing that many was not a difficult thing for us to sort of engineer. We just shipped issue 4 to the printer.
Very specific comment here. I love the paper stock of the cover. I don't know. It just feels very delicious to the hand. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, print is a physical experience. You're holding it. You know, it's one of the compelling aspects of doing a print publication versus all digital. You know, it's a different experience when you're holding it. 15 plus years ago, I was in a meeting with some young magazine staffers, and it was the CEO of Time was talking to a group of us. You know, we were all in our mid-20s, and she had just seen the first iPad. It was before the iPad had launched, and we were talking about, and this was obviously the future was to come. No one knew exactly what was coming, but she said something I never forgot, which is there's a difference between reading something digitally on a screen in print in your hands. And the way she described it was when you're reading something, whether it's on a laptop or an iPad or your phone, your posture is slightly different. You're a little bit hunched forward and there's a bit of a research mentality. You're kind of working. When you're reading something in print, you typically are a little bit sort of like more loose. You're leaned back somewhat. There's a little bit of a recline. It's a bit more leisurely. That always stuck with me of like, there is a feeling. It feels different to have something in print than it does digital. And obviously we know that like the attention span on digital is seconds. And print hopefully slows you down a little bit. Good things happen when we slow down, I think. So we're thrilled. And I mean, we've been print forward for the lifespan of Wild Sam. So it makes sense that we would print this thing.
And finally, for our food neighborhoods, we head to Johannesburg in South Africa. Known for its work hard, play hard culture, it's a city that brings together a vibrant mix of cultures. Elna Schutz heads to the leafy suburb of Rosebank to sample its innovative restaurants.
When you look over sprawling Johannesburg, several distinct skylines are likely to catch your eye. In the south, there's the gritty and historic downtown, and towards the north, you'll see the skyscrapers and headquarters of the richest square mile in Africa, called Sandton. But between them, a third landmark area has risen. It's the leafy suburb of Rosebank, and it's all about fashion, art, design, and of course, food. For a day in the area, I'd start at the two malls, right next to each other. Despite their somewhat cookie-cutter nature, South Africans love a good mall shop for the ease and relative security. These in particular have a mix of everything from traditional South African souvenirs to designer fashion. But what's some retail therapy without sustenance? One of the restaurant highlights of the area is Proud Mary, which is a mid-century design beauty with a scrumptious, globally inspired menu. For those so inclined, it's known for champagne brunch with the girls, though I personally love the glitz of their mirrored roof, sidewalk-facing coffee window so much, I may just grab a pastry to go. After your hands are full and your wallet a little emptier, you could easily stay in the precinct for lunch. But Rosebank's charm is much bigger. A short drive away on Bolton Road is a corner worth of restaurants and bars that are known for their lively nightlife. But there's a few reasons why I love this corner any time of day, especially in the South African sun. Nothing quite says you're relaxing in the buzz of the city like watching the cars and people walk by while you enjoy lunch or beer at Green Dot Cafe or Benchwarmers Sports Bar. As you sit with a coffee or cocktail, you might notice across the street a unique-looking white building that is partly round with a swooshing roof. That's the Goodman, and a well-known spot for something that Rosebank has plenty of, art galleries. Pop in there or make your way up the road to the Keys Art Mile. You'll immediately notice it because it also has a stylish round gallery on the corner. Browse around there and the design stores, but when time is right, make sure to pop upstairs to a lovely little Asian fusion restaurant called Momokuro. Yes, the bowls and bao buns will grab your attention, but make sure you also take in the views over the city, particularly at sunset. But don't fill up too much, because there are some real gems here for dinner. Mm-hmm. Something I love about this corner of Johannesburg is that you find some of the city's best fine dining in the same building as a street side, dig in with your hands, proper burger joint. That's actually what it's called, Burger, spelled BGR. It sits alongside the art gallery in a little row of restaurants that regularly features something interesting and new and has a lovely buzz. But if you can, let me entice you to try that luxury spot I mentioned. Marble and its chef David Higgs are famous on the South African culinary scene and indeed internationally. Marble combines the South African love for cooking on fire with high-end meat and other ingredients. It's truly a treat and a showcasing of what local chefs can do. By now, your stomach, senses, and shopping wishes would probably be full and delighted from a day in Rosebank. But don't rush away just yet. Yes, there's plenty of nightlife and the like here, but there's also the fanciest midnight snack you'll likely ever have. And it's also thanks to Chef Higgs. Below Marble has long been a petrol filling station. Now that might seem to be the place of stale crisps and where culinary dreams go to die, but David Higgs and the team saw it as an opportunity. They established the pantry, which is the fanciest twist on a 24-hour gas station store you can imagine. There's a pizza oven, pastry counter, a lovely corner with wines, and of course some pantry staples, mostly local potties. I guarantee you'll go back to your home or hotel with a happy heart and belly. Rosebank may not be your typical African safari tourist destination, but it does have all the vibrant joy, style, and flavor that Johannesburg has to offer. For Monocle in Johannesburg, I'm Ulna Schütz.
And that's all we've got time for this week's edition of The Curator. The show was produced by David Stevens and presented by me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again next week, and thank you for listening.